I will say, I guess, a little bit about ethical implications, but really what I want to do is remind us that, of course, not everyone greets the prospect of stem cell therapy or stem cell research with unalloyed joy. And there is still opposition of various kinds, and there is, I think, more generally a kind of worrisome trend, sometimes more recently documented in books about the problem. And that is a kind of general skepticism about science in general. And so I'll make a few remarks about that at the end, because as Larry Goldstein reminded us in his opening remarks, much of what we do and much of the success of what goes on in research labs really depends on public acceptance. And I'm still old-fashioned enough to think that much of what goes into public acceptance really has to do with understanding. That once people do have an appreciation of the nature of the science, that attitudes can change. But in any case, I wanted to start with a comment that Charles Krauthammer made many years ago. I don't know whether he still stands by it. But it's one of those arguments that is a bit of a slippery slope, that if you start by handling, even in a very careful way, embryonic stem cells, then ultimately you're likely to end up as a rather corrupt and degenerate moral individual. Needless to say, I think it's pretty obvious that that's not likely to be so. But in thinking about the issues that are very controversial in our contemporary world, including, of course, stem cell research, but also including other issues like abortion and abortifacients, I have found it very useful to look at the history of science and medical technology and how they have been received in the past. Because I think we have the impression that the responses to new technologies that we see in our lifetime are really wholly new, and that we haven't in the past seen anything comparable. And that turns out to be very wrong. There's been opposition of one kind or another from various societies, from various religions, to almost every medical technology and every medical advance, including the dissection of bodies, anesthesia, vaccination. In particular, it started with, of course, vaccination against smallpox, organ transplants, and contraception. Let me just say a little bit about smallpox vaccination, because some of us are old enough to have been vaccinated as children, but many of our children have escaped that. And in fact, they know nothing at all about the horrors of smallpox. But once you describe smallpox as a disease and how tremendously vicious it was, then people do come to some appreciation of it. Nevertheless, it's worth knowing that it was energetically opposed initially. And the opposition lasted for something like 30 years. And during that time, religions, both Catholic and Protestant, vigorously opposed it on many different religious grounds, although they tended all to converge one way or another on the idea that if you had smallpox, then that was God's intent, and that you were interfering with God's plans and God's intent if you were to vaccinate yourself so as to prevent it. So what happened, you might ask? What happened to the opposition? How is it that nobody, almost, anymore would object? And the answer really is the success of smallpox vaccination. And so I mention here that, in my next slide, that in Berlin, from about 1783 to 1791, there were about 4,000 child deaths. That doesn't count the adult deaths. And it doesn't count the tremendous disfigurement that, of course, affects those who do survive smallpox. Notice, however, that between 1814 and 1822, this had fallen in Berlin to 535 child deaths. This was widespread across Europe, and it did not fail to capture the attention of parents and people generally, that this was an incredibly effective way of dealing with a disease. The opposition was interesting. It simply faded away. Nobody stood up and said, we were wrong, please go out and have vaccinations. They simply ceased to talk about it as something that was against God's plan. Then, of course, there is anesthesia. And do I have the slide? No, I don't. Sorry, I didn't update this. Early part of the 19th century, the use of ether as an effective anesthetic was discovered, both in America and also in Scotland. And it was found, of course, that it was extremely useful for those interventions that are very painful. Amputations without any kind of anesthesia is hardly imaginable. We are so unaccustomed to suffering pain that for many of us it's hard to imagine, and I count myself one of them, to have a wisdom tooth extracted without anesthesia. Just a local, mind you, but even then. This, too, was energetically and strongly opposed by many people. In particular, the opposition focused on women, and for the biblical reason that after Eve had been foolish enough to tempt Adam, and they were heaved out of the garden, God had said, as a result, I will greatly multiply your pain in childbearing, and in pain shall you bring forth children. And so the argument was that it would be totally inappropriate in the case of childbirth to use any sort of anesthesia because this would clearly contravene God's will. So lots of us have had one or two babies where it wasn't real fun, but it wasn't desperately terrible. But many women do have to have, for example, cesarean sections, or they do have to have interventions that are extremely painful. And it was in those sorts of cases that this particularly came to notice. Now again, you might ask, so what actually happened? Because you would be hard put to it to find now anybody who would strenuously object on biblical grounds to the use of anesthesia. And the answer is pretty much the same as what happened with regard to smallpox vaccinations. People realized that it was effective, that it made a huge difference in their lives, and the opposition simply drifted away. So once it became commonplace and people had enough courage to defy the church and go ahead, it didn't. But there were certainly some very nasty incidents. And one particular incident in northern Scotland, a woman who had had to have a cesarean section was given an anesthetic. The baby was born. The country folk were so outraged by the use of anesthesia that they collected the sticks, burned, built a big fire, tossed her and the baby on. Interestingly enough, they did not toss the physician on. I mean, there's some good things to all stories, I suppose. We forget that Pope Boniface, who lived from 1234 to 1303, in about, I think, 1280, had put out a papal bull opposing the dissection of cadavers. And that was because it was his firm belief that you went to heaven as a whole, as the whole body, and that if you were dissected, and for example, as kings often had themselves dissected, so they could consecrate this church and that church and that church, so because there was a bit of them everywhere, he felt that this was deeply inappropriate. Again, Nobody actually removed that bull from the bullery, or whatever it's called. It's just that it ceased to function. And nobody now is particularly concerned that cadavers must not. More recently, in 1956, it may surprise you to know that Pope Pius XII condemned ex cathedra transplants of organs from living donors. This, to the best of my knowledge, but my knowledge of church history is not entirely impeccable, to the best of my knowledge, this was never rescinded. But it is widely ignored, as are the proscriptions against contraception. Widely ignored, but even now, clergy in the church will recognize the virtue and the sort of moral appropriateness of a living sibling donating a kidney to another. And it has become sufficiently commonplace that I think we are really quite stunned by the idea that Pius XII would have proclaimed such an edict. I think actually his grounds were these, that he feared that people would begin to sell bits and pieces of themselves, as indeed we know can happen. But I think in these sorts of cases, one of the things that's very important is to realize that you can always mesh the new technologies with appropriate regulations, and that the regulations can move with the technologies so that some of the more worrisome things can actually be avoided. Finally, I want to say just a little something about embryos, since, after all, some philosophers have had things to say about them. Now, one of the great Catholic theologians is St. Thomas Aquinas, lived in the 13th century. And amongst the great works that is frequently referred to is Summa Contra Gentiles, which was written between 1258 and 1264. Now, during that time, it was, first of all, not altogether unusual for women to practice infanticide under certain kinds of conditions. For example, they already had many children, and they were not able to support more, and so before they actually began to lactate, they would let the child go. And often there were myths surrounding the process, so that this was not an entirely unacceptable thing. As with women currently in South American countries and elsewhere, there were also natural abortifacients, and there were ways of bringing about a miscarriage. The church did not think that that was a mortal sin. Abortion was not considered a mortal sin until 1870. Until that time, it was considered an unacceptable thing to do, and an unfortunate thing to do. So you confessed it and you got to say some Hail Marys or something of that kind. But you weren't actually excommunicated, or you weren't expected to actually go to hell. Now, part of this actually depended on Aquinas. And Aquinas's considered view was that the rational soul, by which he meant that by virtue of which we are humans, that the rational soul cannot enter the fetus until the proper body organs are prepared. Now, that's partly because, as a sort of Aristotelian, he had a view about embryonic development. And so he thought, on the basis of what they knew about in embryological development, that first there was a vegetative soul that was not in any sense a person. So the conceptus or the blastocyst is not a person in Aquinas' view. It's just, it has the vegetative soul, by which he just meant it grows like a vegetable, roughly speaking. And then after a while, it has a nutritive and sensory soul, by which he meant that it can respond to things like pain, but it still doesn't have that organization. He didn't mean by soul some spooky thing. He just meant it didn't have that organization by virtue of which it could be rational or be a human. And he thought then that at 90 days of gestation, females got their rational soul. And as always, 40 days, men had their rational soul. What can I say? All right, I'm about to finish up. So the other thing that Larry Goldstein said that really stuck in my mind was that good science policy requires good science. And I know many of the people in this room have played an important role in many respects in bringing the messages of science and science understanding to congressional committees, to governors, and to the NIH and so forth. But it is, of course, of the first essence. And so my last slide really is a way of saying something about this wonderful institution that Roger Bingham has put together called the Science Network, which really aims to try to bring the best of science that there is and make it as public as possible. And he's done many things in order to achieve those, the things that he has achieved so far. There's so much more that could be done. And I think counterbalancing this skepticism about science that I mentioned earlier is a real hunger to know. But to know in such a way that you don't already have to have a PhD in order to kind of get the hang of the story. And so, I mean, I've heard a number of people in this room, including Evan Snyder and others, give these sorts of talks. And it can be done, and it's not always the most fun thing in the world, but it can actually be a lot of fun as well. And that is something I think that we need to do.